The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast. Hello, I'm Sarah Crown. This week, A.L. Kennedy returns to our bookshops with a story of love, death, and mediums. But why did she set this tale of moral adversity on board a cruise liner? And with the Edinburgh International Book Festival almost upon us, we preview the best of the fest and reveal our plans to take you there with this podcast. A.L. Kennedy has made a name for herself in stand-up comedy in recent years, but the many fans of her fiction will be thrilled to hear that she's just published her first novel since Day, which won the 2007 Costa Prize. She describes The Blue Book as a fiction which may not always be lying. The story drifts between truth and deception and features Beth and Arthur, a pair of fake mediums with a shared professional and sexual history, who meet again on board a cruise liner crossing the Atlantic. I met up with A.L. Kennedy last week and started by asking her why she wanted to write about psychics.
It was a family interest. I mean, it goes a long way back. My grandpa, who was my favourite person ever, was really into magic, and he taught me how to do a version of Three Card Monty, which is the only card trick I can do. And he gave me a book about Houdini. He sort of taught me that people would fool you. So he taught me self-defence with sort of cards and things, up to a point. And he taught me self-defence, literally, how to disarm an attacker. And he, in a way that made you unafraid, he made it into a game. So I can put anybody into a half Nelson without thinking. In fact, somebody tried to put it in my pocket in Paris, and he was in a half Nelson before I thought about it. And I then had to think, I don't know how to let him go. And he might have a knife. Grandpa, he didn't teach you...
Like learning to fly but not learning how to land.
Yeah, but he made you feel very confident. But he had a big interest in magic, so I've always been sort of interested in it as a thing to know about, and in fooling people. He was very much, if you were in the family, that was fine, and everybody else was fair game, sort of. And there was spiritualism in the family as a practiced religion. My great aunt Caroline was a spiritualist, and my grandmother did predictive readings and completely believed in it. And my mother's had, you know, quite a lot of unusual experiences that would be sort of paranormal or supernormal or whatever. So I sort of grew up with it being around, and I was very interested in it, and then I got more and more interested in it. And more interested just with, you know, the way that people manipulate people.
Mm.
In all ways. I get annoyed about people misusing language in order to lie, which is, you know, politicians and lawyers and... But it's such a big industry now, because it's such a turbulent time, and when people have nothing to cling to, they go to very predictable areas, and one of them is psychic TV, or go and get your palm read, or whatever, and it's just you're giving somebody 50, 60, 70 quid to chat to you. Sure, you could chat to a prostitute, and she'd be quite glad of the rest, and you could spend less money, and being... A prostitute should have at least the amount of knowledge of human nature that a palmist would.
But this is one of the things that comes up, isn't it? That Arthur, who is one of these two people,
yeah,
he spends his life dealing with people who've been bereaved and ostensibly giving them access to their loved ones.
Yeah.
But it's all pretense. But his overwhelming view of it is that it's a kind of kindly deception.
Yeah, and I think he can live with himself by thinking that it's... Houdini used the phrase, the right way to do wrong, which in his sense was the sort of classic and elegantly correct way to screw people up. Yeah, I think he feels, and I think he's correct in feeling, that there are many terrible and insoluble things in life, like people that you love dying or leaving or being injured, and that quite often there is no real-world solution to that, other than maybe the passage of time. But basically not.
Mm.
You just learn to live without something that's been amputated. And he kind of, for people who've had a traumatic and very much unclosed experience, where there's never been a body, it's been lost in a plane crash, or it's gone into a body pit and there's been sort of civil unrest or whatever, he can do something pro bono for them, making sure that at the end of the experience, he says, this is the end of the experience. They are not coming back. They will not come back for anybody other than me, and I'm saying that they will not come back. So you can't get addicted, and you won't get suckered into paying somebody else to provide you being able to meet your son whenever. But the other side of it is that he funds himself royally by making other people addicted to fee-paying mediumship and going to meet billionaires and millionaires in Manhattan and fleecing them and lying to them and selling the other thing, which is easy to sell if you're an arms manufacturer or somebody working in anti-terror protection provision. You sell people the nightmare and you sell them the cure. It may be that the nightmare doesn't exist, and the fact that their cure works may not mean that the cure works. It may mean that there was not a problem in the first place. If you sell threat, it sells fantastically well. And I mean, we now know about the Cold War that the Russians were infinitely less threatening, and we know factually who was overselling the case in order to get more money for which budget. If you sell people protection, it's everybody wants to be safe. It's like that lovely advert for, I can't remember what soap it is, but they managed to link it with whether a mother's son is wearing a bicycle helmet or not. So underneath it all is, if you don't do this domestic thing, which is a choice, and one soap is as good as another, your son will die of a horrible head injury because you're a bad mother.
It's effective.
Absolutely. It's because these people know where you're wiring it. So, the suggestion is sort of there. It's like, well, you wouldn't want your son to die. I mean, you'd want your dishwasher to be functional. I don't think those are connected, really. So he's selling fear. And I've certainly, I had lots and lots of readings done with people. And that there were people who would flat out say, your family appear to love you, but actually many of them are working against you because they're envious of you, and your co-workers are friendly to your face, but because you're better at your job than they are, they are trying to get you fired, and basically I'm the only person that knows this, and you have to keep coming back to me, and then I can make you completely dependent, and I can tell you the solutions to the non-problems that you have, and then I'll make some other problems. One of them was the most expensive person I saw. I could admire her complete sociopathy evil, but I didn't want to ever see her again.
But it's also, as well as being Arthur's story and the story of his negotiations with these sort of morally complex situations in which he finds himself, it's also Beth's story, and she and Arthur were partners in the past, and then she opted out of it.
Yeah.
But they also had this very intense sexual relationship as well.
Mm.
It becomes, over the course of the novel, a story of their love and whether or not it can survive.
Yeah.
Because the book is full of these codes that they use to communicate with one another. It seemed to me to be about, the codes that we use when we're in love and ways in which people manage to talk about love without really talking about it.
I suppose. I really wanted it to be a novel about sort of tenderness, really, and that you've got a couple that love each other and have tried to avoid emotional proximity by doing physical intensity, and that they've just kind of gone through that, and that the choice is now either to do something physical which has meaning.
So it was
to get them to the point where I could kind of credibly have people who'd gone on a, I hate saying gone on a journey, but they'd gone through a series of experiences that meant they had to be kind.
So this is a book that is about death in large part,
yeah.
Love in very large part,
yeah.
Trauma generally, and moral difficulty.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is set on a cruise liner, would sound seem to lend itself more to sort of comedy and farce.
I wondered comedy.
Why you chose that as the setting. Well, it works very well, just to be clear.
Telegraph doesn't think so. I knew they would be in hotels a lot, and I was just going to have a succession of hotels. But then I was on an ocean liner because I hate flying, going to America. And as soon as I got on it, you just thought, okay, it can't be anywhere other than this. Because you're in this, particularly at night, you're in this tiny, lighted, bobbing, vulnerable, stupid, ridiculous, vain thing in a nightmare. And there's just maelstrom that would kill you in moments, and that's eating the ship and everything. They paint everything all the time, partly because everybody would complain if they didn't, but partly because the water eats it, the air eats it, the waves eat it. So it just seemed to be a huge kind of metaphor for how ridiculous it is to be alive and constantly threatened. And I mean, there were force nine gales the first time I was on, and you would be wondering about it, and people would be tangoing, and incredibly old people as well.
That was one of the scenes that I really loved, was this when this, 90% of the boat is throwing up,
yeah.
And the remaining 10%, who are all 80,
yeah.
are tangoing.
Yeah.
very slowly, as I recall.
Because you've got that slight, they have to accommodate the movement of the ship, and you just thought, again, good on you for being of that age, and you're dancing. Yeah, you get a wide spectrum of the over 50 area of people. You did meet some very interesting and gentlemanly people, like the Francis character. You did meet people who were just terribly nice people.
It's because he's a great character. His wife, who we sort of learn is unwell.
Yeah.
It's sort of a preview of the couples that we've seen Arthur dealing with, where one half has died. You have it kind of in advance here, where you see where it's going.
Yeah.
And you understand why people reach out for that kind of comfort, I suppose.
I think, yeah, they were sort of there to, you know, I didn't want it to be an ageist book, because obviously a lot of it is her ranting about people who are ludicrously elderly. And it is quite funny, if you're not old, to look at old people, but I did want people who were old and still human, a sort of lasting and dignified and proper love that had lasted for decades and that was still there and that was reasonable and that was the way it should be for two people to have worked out how to be together. And yet they are still facing, obviously, the wife has something horrible wrong and may not be around for very long, and obviously the husband is, you know, at an age where he won't be around for very much longer either, and it will start to stop being fun. I didn't want it just to be ranting about people who have more money than sense, that you actually had, you know, there are people who have enough money to be an ocean liner who are not unpleasant people. They just happen to have decided to spend their money in that manner and to be doing that thing for each other.
Okay, thanks very much indeed for talking to us.
No trouble.
That was A.L. Kennedy, and the Blue Book is published by Jonathan Cape. With the Edinburgh Fringe now well underway, and the Edinburgh International Festival starting today, all that remains is for the Book Festival to kick off tomorrow, and of course, that's the bit we're interested in. For the next 2.5 weeks, the city will be overrun by authors and book lovers, all converging on the site in Charlotte Square Gardens to take part in what's billed as the world's biggest conversation about literature. And this year, for the first time, The Guardian is sponsoring the event. We'll be bringing you 4 podcasts from the festival, speaking to authors including Andrew O'Hagan and Ian Rankin, Jackie Kay and Sebastian Barry. You'll be able to listen to the first Edinburgh Books podcast on Monday, but for now, we're interested in what there is to look forward to. I spoke to Festival Director Nick Barley earlier to hear about how everything's shaping up.
A couple of days before we open, and everything's pretty much in place. All being well, we're ready to go.
Brilliant. And so who are the real headline names this year? Who are you boasting to people about?
That's a pretty hard question, because there are 797 authors in the programme.
Good grief.
So I feel a bit like the headmaster of a school with lots and lots of children in it, and I'm a bit loath to name my favourite. I'm very excited about the events we have in relation to the Arab Spring, of course, ongoing events, Arab Spring. So Alan Little, who's the BBC journalist, is chairing a number of these events, including authors such as Akhdaf Suef and Hisham Mattar, the Libyan author.
Mm.
So the opportunity to give them a context in which to discuss the Arab Spring events, particularly, of course, in the context of what's been happening in the streets of British cities just this week. So I think when I boast about people who are coming, I'm really boasting, I think, about how topical some of the authors are and how much their writing reflects concerns which are very, very relevant right now. There are loads and loads of great events for which there are still some tickets available.
Okay, so still time to book up and come along to things. And so what are you personally looking forward to most?
I'm really excited about some of the events where we're trying to innovate. Literary festivals are always fascinating because of the content of what's spoken about. But in terms of, for a festival director, to try to innovate with the format of events is always exciting. And sometimes that can be as simple as a sort of unusual combinations of people, of conversationalists. So, for example, I'm really excited that Irvin Welsh is joining us, not only to talk about his own work, but in one event he's going to be the interviewer. He'll be interviewing James Robertson. And I think it'll be the first time Irvin has been the interviewer rather than the interviewee in a book festival. Similarly, the First Minister, Alex Salmond, will be coming not to peddle his party line, but to interview Ian Banks, the sci-fi writer.
Wow.
And so I think these give a different kind of perspective on writing.
So what is it then, following on from that, that you think that makes Edinburgh as a books festival stand out from the crowd? Because there are so many books festivals these days. I think that it can be difficult for people to decide which one to go to. So why would you tell people to come to Edinburgh as opposed to anywhere else?
Well, what's often said about us is that we're the biggest in the world. That's not what I would say about us, because I think our aim should not be to be the biggest, but to be the best. And so I think there are two aspects which really make us stand out. One is our internationalism. Of course, there are many great book festivals around the world, but the proportion of international authors is, I think, the highest in Edinburgh of any book festival. And the second thing is innovation. We're trying out lots of new ways of thinking about literature and ways of asking literature to tell us about ourselves. And so, for example, every evening we have a new kind of festival, a mini festival within the festival called Unbound, which is free and which allows authors to present their work in innovative formats. So there'll be singing, there'll be various different kinds of performances. And so really it's a sort of festival of innovation.
Okay, and then the last question is the one that I have to ask, I'm afraid, and that's, what's the weather like?
Well, every August in Edinburgh, you take
it's a lottery.
Some days it's absolutely glorious, and other days there is just a little drop of rain.
Okay, so be honest, what's today like?
It was raining earlier on, it's not raining now.
Okay.
And I think the forecast is not too bad for the next few weeks. But my advice would be to come along, bring an umbrella, and just enjoy it, because once you're inside the festival tent, it doesn't really matter what the weather's like out there. It's the quality of the ideas that matters.
I'm now joined in the studio by The Guardian's children's site editor, Michelle Pawley, and Lisa Allardyce, editor of The Guardian Review. And Lisa, if I can start with you, this weekend's review is completely given over to festival recommendations, isn't it?
It is. We've got an Edinburgh International Book Festival special this weekend, and our cover story is writers who are going, who they're most looking forward to seeing, because I think we as punters and people in the audience forget sometimes that the writers themselves, this is a chance, it's a small place with writers from all around the world coming together, and that it's exciting for them and a chance for them to see and listen to some of their heroes as well.
So who's recommending what?
Well, it was wonderful because rarely everybody chose somebody completely different without any prompting from me, which was, it was very nice. Michelle Faber has chosen Alistair Gray, who is bookending the festival, and Alistair Gray is one of the main attractions of it. So that's two Scottish writers there. Colin Thubon chose Ali Smith, another Scottish writer, which surprised me. Sebastian Barry chose Michael Longley, who he says that he wished he'd seen Dickens' Comrade or Tennyson reading, and that 100 years from now, people will be envious that they didn't hear Michael Longley.
Oh, that's a very nice thing to say. So all of us going up there and listening to Michael Longley should feel very lucky then.
Tom McCarthy is very excited at seeing one of his heroes, Robert Coover. He remembers being in Prague hungover 20 years ago and reading one of his short stories, a version of Kafka's Metamorphosis, and he's very much looking forward to that. Julia Donaldson is looking forward to talking to Nick Sharratt. She wants to know how he goes about illustrating her books. Jeff Dyer is rather nervous about seeing Alan Hollinghurst because he says that he has a sense that Hollinghurst knows things about us that we all try and conceal from ourselves. And he knows Hollinghurst very slightly, and he feels it will be safe to see him on stage.
So what's your particular festival highlight then? What are you looking forward to the most?
I will have to go and see or listen to Colm Toybean just because he's talking about his short stories and you could listen to Colm talk forever. He always reads, he can't help himself. He's the same as Sebastian Barry, and just listening to them do Irish is glorious. And I think one of the interesting themes of the festival, the revolution theme, I'd like to get along to the Ardaf Suif and Hisham Mattar event, which will be interesting for obvious reasons this
year.
Yes.
And Michelle, what about you? Let's start off with just the things that you're really looking forward to, first of all.
Well, it's a really packed programme for kids at Edinburgh this year. It's a great lineup, and they've got a lot of very good homegrown authors, but they've also got some children's authors coming from much further afield. And I'm particularly interested in Neil Gaiman, who's going to be doing an adults event and a kids event. He's coming over from the States. His events are always fantastic, and he always has an amazingly long signing queue as well. So yeah, that's something to look out for. Sean Tan is coming over from Australia. He's on a bit of a world tour at the moment because he was in Sweden receiving the Astrid Lindgren Prize recently. He's a picture book writer, illustrator, artist. He's won an Oscar for adapting one of his picture books.
Goodness.
And he's really on a high at the moment. He has a lot of insight into his own working process. Also from Australia, there's Maurice Gleitzman, who did the so-called Holocaust trilogy, Once, Now, Then. And he's going to be in conversation with Jason Wallace, who's a debut author who won the Costa Children's Prize this year.
So that's a really international feeling, kids' festival then.
Definitely.
And what about, now this is a question that is particularly close to my heart, young children in books festival, because I have a three-year-old and my feeling is that he's probably a bit too young to sort of be entertained by any of the events there, but are there things for younger children?
There are. In fact, three is probably about the starting age. There's a lot of events for 3 to 6-year-olds and some of them are based around characters. So you've got, you know, fun with Spot the Dog and playing with Peter Rabbit and friends. But there's also a lot more traditional events. You've got storytelling, you've got nursery rhymes, you've got songwriting, and there are a lot of picture book illustrators getting involved with drawing events. So Nick Sharratt is the illustrator in residence. He's famous for illustrating Jacqueline Wilson's books and also working with Julia Donaldson, the new children's laureate. And he's trying to create a giant frieze for the Books Festival where everybody is encouraged to go and get involved.
And that's just about all we have time for this week. Listen out for the first of our Edinburgh Books podcasts this coming Monday. In this week's Guardian Review, as well as all the Edinburgh authors, we have a profile of Val McDermid and Ian Rankin reviewing Janice Galloway's memoir. In the Observer New Review on Sunday, Tim Adams reviews On Canaan's Side by Sebastian Barry, Tracy K. Smith reviews Harlem is Nowhere by Sharifa Rhodes Pitts, and Rachel Cook takes a look at The Long Goodbye, a memoir of grief by Megan O'Rourke. But for now, thanks to Michelle Pawley, Lisa Allardyce, Nick Barley and A.L. Kennedy. The producer was Ian Chambers. I'm Sarah Crown and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.